The tagline for this 1960 film was, "They were seven, and they fought like 700.
That's a lie.
Yeah, I know. It's
that's a blatant lie.
It's like, it's 700, really? You couldn't even say like 7,000, but whatever. Then the tagline for the 2016 remake was, "Justice has a number."
Corny.
So there's a number. The number is seven. It's a magnificent number. Do you know what we're talking about?
We are talking about lucky number seven.
Isn't it lucky number 11?
Oh, God, that's right. You're right. Joke over. No, we're talking about Magnificent Seven. Okay. With that said,
I'm Nicole.
And I'm Rolando.
This is Remakes, Reboots, and Revivals, an original podcast
about unoriginality.
Woof.
Got it.
Bear with us, guys. We are hot. It's really hot in my apartment, so we might sound exhausted, but it's not our lives. It's the heat.
No, it's also partly my life. I'm still recovering from tonsillitis.
That's true. Yes, Rolando was sick.
I was basically dead for like a week,
and then I pulled my back out on Thursday, and I just recovered from it today, which is Tuesday.
Man, you're not even 30 yet, right?
I'm not even
30. You're not even 30.
I'm falling apart.
No, it's all right. I relate. I think when I was 28, I had like a bad back too. Like I pulled my back from doing something really stupid on Memorial Day weekend, lifting up a girl.
Oh, ooh.
And I pulled my back and it doesn't hit you till like a month or so later.
Uh-huh.
And then that pain will last for a year.
Oh, I got mine from putting my backpack on.
Oh,
and the pain was immediate.
See, at least I was like doing something to like impress people at a bar.
But okay, so we're talking about The Magnificent Seven today. And before we get into it, again, our wonderful, beautiful, magnificent two producers, Eddie Z and Josh. Hey, guys.
Magnificent duo, maybe?
Ooh.
That's awesome. I'll go with that, Josh.
So we're going to do something a little unusual because our podcast, we really focus on like recent remakes, reboots, and revivals, right?
Yes.
So we're not going to dabble too much in remakes from like back in the day. Oh. And when I say back in the day, it's for the means of this podcast. Trust me, I watch movies from like any decade. I don't actually think movies from 10 years ago are back in the day. But
see, it's so funny. I think any movie before 2000 is back in the day.
That's terrible.
Yeah.
The Magnificent Seven was actually a remake of a Japanese film that we have to talk about this film. We would be doing it a disservice and disrespect if we did not talk about this film. So to prelude the Magnificent Seven topic, we're going to have to talk about a 1954 film called Seven Samurai.
Full disclosure, I have not seen Seven Samurai. Although I've had to see parts of it for my undergraduate when we were studying international film.
Did any of it leave an impact on you?
Maybe not necessarily the filmmaker. I didn't see the whole movie, so it's hard to like say it left an impact on me. I think the lessons,
from what you saw, yeah.
Right, the lessons learned, like what our professor was at least teaching us about the film, that kind of more so stuck with me. And we focused, it was mostly on kind of the use of, well, all right, give a little background of the movie before we start.
So if you go in the Wikipedia of Seven Samurai, it's going to say, since its release, Seven Samurai has consistently ranked highly on critics' lists of the greatest films. It has remained highly influential, often seen as one of the most remade, reworked, referenced films in cinema. Oh my God, that's a good name for a podcast. Remade, reworked, and referenced. Right? They got the three R's there too.
That's pretty good.
But
copyright.
This is one of the only times that a Wikipedia page has actually gotten it right. This is a highly regarded film, and actually, there's a couple of other remakes. Bug's Life is a remake of Seven Samurai. Did you pick that up?
Oh,
I know
actually,
you like Bug's Life, right?
I do like Bug's Life. That's so funny. I never thought about that. Well, again, I never seen the movie. I know of the movie, but it was not
true.
That
but like after seeing Magnificent Seven, did you see the Bug's Life connection?
I can see now the Bug's Life connection okay. For sure. Yeah,
Seven Samurai is done by a director called Akira Kurosawa, and he is often regarded as probably the most renowned Japanese filmmaker.
I feel like Nicole, you should say it like white people say it because I feel like our audiences don't say it with such a Japanese flair.
True. I have to admit, guys, I'm a huge Japanese film nerd. I'm actually not an anime nerd. And I'm not into like other things that people are usually into when it comes to Japan, but I love their cinema. I'm so huge on it. Akira Kurosawa.
That's exactly how white people say it.
In Japan, they call him Kurosawa-san. But he's just, yeah, most renowned Japanese filmmaker. This was made in 1954. And historically speaking, this is only like less than 10 years after the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so Japan is still recovering from this complete and utter devastation. And I think that the films, and Japan went through their golden age in the 1950s. The films that Japan released, by prominent filmmakers at least, in the early 1950s of Japan are some of the most incredible films you'll ever see, period. And what was so groundbreaking, to sum it up, about Seven Samurai was that it was a heartfelt film that had a lot of action in it. So they took two different genres that people didn't think went together and they made them go together. I mean, we're not going to focus too much on it. I personally think this is a great film. It's not my favorite Kurosawa film. I think it's a great film and people should see it. They're going to be thankful they did, even though it's a 3.5-hour film. And I know it's hard for people to watch movies of that length, especially of the 50s these days. Mm. And a different language and black and white. I get it. It's a great film, though. You will hopefully be happy you watched it.
Right.
So I said I'm a big Japanese film nerd. I'm actually a big Western fan.
Really?
Is that shocking?
That's so shocking. Westerns are so misogynistic. I wouldn't expect you to enjoy Westerns.
I won't say that there are films that don't succumb to that. You're right. That's a bit, though, of a generalization, because actually in most of these films, women don't even exist.
That's true.
Like Magnificent Seven, how many women did we really see that had speaking lines? Right?
They were all prostitutes and wenches.
Does not pass the Bechdel test.
No, that's not true. What's it called? In the Magnificent Seven, they weren't talking. So by that theory alone.
Well, the first thing is, does it have any women in it? Do they have any lines? Fail.
I'm trying to think if there's anyone in the Magnificent Seven women who had names. I don't think the women did have names. There's a wife of this woman who got shot. No, she didn't even have a name. Oh, Chico's girlfriend.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
But she doesn't talk to any other woman.
Yeah, no, so it totally fails the Bechdel test. But yeah, so there's hardly any women in Westerns, and it's just like, I actually really like them for reasons that are like kind of odd. I like the presentation of masculinity, and I also kind of like the mythos it presents of masculinity. Sometimes I agree with it, and sometimes I think it's so ridiculous and so far-fetched, but I find it entertaining. And I also think that for the most part, sometimes it doesn't do this, but Westerns, they're fun. They're like this weird sense of adventure, and it's this weird like part of American history that, especially the Italians, but like when we really tap into it and we present America for what it really was, it was a dirty place. It was gross. It was terrible. And all the best Westerns present it like that. And I like looking at our American past like that.
It's so interesting. I guess the reason I never really cared for Westerns is because there's like almost a glorification of kind of that lifestyle. You know, so it's funny, right? I think a lot of my friends would describe me as way more metropolitan out of my whole social circle of friends. And, you know, kind of that whole idea of like the frontier, being dirty, riding horses, nature, never appealed to me, ever.
Really?
And I enjoy going camping and, you know, the extent of it is a weekend. Mm-hmm. But like this whole romanticizing of cowboys and kind of like hard labor and guns even, I was just like, it's never, ever appealed to me.
I'm surprised also, that Dirty Men doesn't appeal to
you. Yeah, me, nope, not my scene. I think my fiance's scene, but definitely not mine. it's just never been a genre I gravitate towards.
Definitely. I really get why people don't like Westerns, especially now, but when done right, they actually can be, and like they're kind of like musicals. If you give it a shot and you kind of let go of the reasons why you think it might not be good, you'll be surprised because it might actually surprise you.
Speaking of musical, so The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, that's a Western musical, right?
Yes.
So,
and then like Blazing Saddles is a comedic Western. Yes, but it's very much Western.
And that's a good one.
Yeah. All right, so let's skip forward to 1960, and we're going to talk now about the John Sturges Magnificent Seven remake. That's Bonanza.
Wow, shit.
But I'm so glad you know the Bonanza theme song.
Everyone knows a Bonanza theme song.
Well, do you know the Magnificent Seven theme song?
Uh-huh. I just don't know it off the top of my head.
It's like...
That's it. Yeah.
So this is a time in American film history where films were not doing good. The television came into the public lifestyle in the early 50s. And by the late 50s, everyone had a TV and no one was going to the movies. But why would they go to the movies? They were still doing the same old shit they've been doing for the past three decades. So that's why the 60s were so important. But this was the beginning of the 60s and Hollywood hadn't quite caught on yet.
That's so interesting that that was happening in the 60s because I think it's happening now.
Yep.
That's so funny.
It takes Hollywood a while to catch up.
Oh, yeah. So that's very much like today, right? Like, I think so. You know, we're in the golden age of TV. Movies have no idea. So that's where we're getting actually all these fucking remakes, reboots,
mm-hmm.
you know, just all these properties over and over again.
For sure.
Rehashed. So.
And that's what Hollywood does when they don't know what to do. They're like, oh, let's just produce the same thing over and over and over and over again. And what people loved were Westerns. I mean, Gunsmoke, Bonanza, like you said, there's so many TV Westerns that were everybody was watching.
Is Bonanza that old?
Yeah. This was the time period of Bonanza.
I didn't know Bonanza was that old. I actually thought Bonanza was like 80s.
But it was so popular that the song is definitely embedded in our pop
right.
culture.
I mean, I know it from The Simpsons.
Yeah, that's, yeah. They were like, people love Westerns, period, even though movie Westerns were dying out. So they were like, let's take this great Japanese film and adapt it naturally for the West. And that's pretty much, I think, a good historical look on it. Sure. So did you see it?
Yes, I saw for this podcast, The Magnificent Seven.
What did you think?
It was all right.
Okay.
I wasn't, I don't know. It's doing research, right? It's like hailed as one of the greatest Westerns. Not yeah. the greatest. It goes there. I mean, it's in the, what's it called? It's in the historical film, you know, it's been labeled by the
American, National Registry?
Yeah.
It's yeah, like the Library of Congress.
The
yeah.
Library of Congress's film of significance.
Yeah. the whole of significances.
And I was watching it. I was just like waiting for kind of that like moment. Like, right? It's just like, all right, what's going to be that big moment where this becomes important? And I don't think it ever hit that for me.
No.
It was, I don't know. It was fine. It's an enjoyable movie to watch.
Yeah. I think that, so for me, like I said, huge Western fan, this is not even on my top 10. I love, as Quentin Tarantino says it, guys on a mission movie. And I love when a bunch of guys get together and they have a mission and then the whole movie is just whether or not they accomplish their mission.
Yeah.
And this is one of the first films that does that. This film is not exactly shot by shot, of course, but story-wise, this is Seven Samurai. And yet you would think that a film that takes so heavily, it's pretty much the same exact story put in the West. You think it would, it's not even, it doesn't even hold it like a torch to Seven Samurai.
The opening is very similar to Seven Samurai.
Everything's similar to Seven Samurai.
I remember we had to watch the beginning for Seven Samurai and like they go, terrorize this poor little village and they kill a guy in cold blood right there. Same thing mm-hmm. happened here, Magnificent Seven.
Yeah, but in this time, they're Mexican band.
In this time, here they're, well, Texican, I would say, right? Because they're like yeah. kind of like, isn't that area of like Mexico, Texas, you know? So yeah, so I'm not 100% sure what time period this movie takes place, but I don't know. It's like that's my whole problem with Westerns. Maybe it's because I don't know history itself, mm-hmm. but like it's all just this vague idea of like the past.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. There's not like a geographical sense that we can latch on to. Yeah, it's like, are they in California? Are they not?
Like, I also don't know because the Westerns all look the same. I don't know like where, I don't know like what, I don't know where they are ever. Right. Uh-huh. Like, I just know they're out West somewhere. Texas probably. and I never know. It's such a, like, I feel like it's such a fantasy. Like, it's just not a real thing. Like, no one lived like that. No one dressed like that. No one spoke like
that's
that.
Actually kind of why I like it. I find it very, like, it is like a fantasy. I suppose I have this weird fantasy of just, like, being out there in, like, no man's land without a name. Just, like, roaming from town to town. But,
on a horseback.
Yeah.
Just marauding towns. You know?
But yeah, so the film is very similar to Seven Samurai. Down to the Horst Buchholz character. His name was Chico.
Chico was a character in the...
Yes, he was played by the legendary Toshiro Mifune. And such a great fucking character.
How would white people pronounce that name, Nicole?
Toshiro Mifune.
That sounds about right.
I think Toshiro Mifune is like is the greatest actor ever. So fucking versatile. Like an unbelievable actor. Could go from playing a dirty bandit to like a straight-laced doctor. Like, he's just incredible. I'm sorry, I could talk forever about Toshiro Mifune, right? But funny enough, Steve McQueen really wanted the role of Chico, but it was given to Horace Butchels. Rightly so, because he looks more like a Mexican, because, you know, the character was raised
Horace
by
Horace supposed to be Mexican?
Farmers. Yeah.
Because well, isn't he like a German actor? He was a German actor.
Well, this film was not cast very well in terms of, you know, Mexicans, but like Eli Wallach, he's a very well-known Jewish actor, played Calvera, the Mexican bandit leader. And then he went on to be the ugly in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Yes.
But he could pass more for Mexican than Steve McQueen can.
I would agree with you, yeah, for sure.
So yeah, but apparently he was a dick to Horace Butchels because of that. He was like totally salty about it.
I think it was also maybe Steve McQueen was just jelly of how good Chico looked. Yeah. Chico was way more attractive than Steve McQueen.
You think so?
Oh, Chico was so hot. He is like, what's it called? He reminds me of actually like, I don't find James Franco attractive, but Chico reminded me of like an attractive James Franco.
I could see that. I can even see his little brother, Dave Franco.
Okay, yeah. Dave Franco was much hotter than James Franco. Yeah,
that's I would agree with that.
I didn't say his name because I feel like no one knows who Dave Franco is.
But, oh my God, but Yul Brynner, though.
Nothing.
Not even his voice?
Not a little wiggle in my tingly areas.
So true voice. Oh my gosh, Yul Brynner does it for me.
That's a bald guy, right? The main character,
yeah.
Chris?
Yeah.
No, nothing.
It's maybe because he has a hat on. You can't see his beautiful bald head.
No.
But his voice. But you can hear his voice and you don't like him?
Man, I could. What's it called? I'm like listening to his voice in my head right now and I was just like, nope, nothing.
Guns are very expensive and hard to get. Why don't you hire men?
Men?
Gunmen. Nowadays, men are cheaper than guns.
I'm partial, though, because, like, since I'm such a fan of old-time Hollywood and especially, like, a certain type of movie that came out in the 60s and 70s, like, B-movies or, like, action movies, people I really like are in this movie, like Charles Bronson.
Oh, so Charles Bronson. I was surprised at how much I like him because I hate Charles Bronson. I don't hate Charles Bronson as necessarily... I don't hate him as a person. I don't hate him. I don't even hate his movies, per se. I kind of hate what his movies represent.
What his movies represent.
That whole vengeance and like the gun is the way. It's so heavy NRA. I'm not a fan of Death Wish and stuff. I'm like, what's it called? I'm very much morally opposed to those movies.
That's such a, I must say though, that's kind of a 2018 projection on a different era and a different, and these are also action films. He's a hitman in most of these films, or he's a gunslinger.
He's a cop getting revenge. Yeah.
Are you talking about the Death Wish films?
I'm talking about the Death Wish films.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, I mean, his family was like because pillaged there were like and 20 murdered.
20 of them.
Yeah. Did you ever see Death Wish 9? I wish I was dead.
Oh, the Simpsons.
I do love doing my Charles Bronson impersonation. Emma, no dice.
No, but I did like his character Bernardo in this movie.
Yeah.
You think I'm brave because I carry a gun? Well, your fathers are much braver because they carry responsibility for you, your brothers, your sisters, and your mothers.
That was probably the only character I felt any sympathy at the end. Like, I think when, just spoiler alert, guys, movie's been out for like over what? 50 years.
Yeah.
So Charles Bronson's character, he gets shot in the big final showdown at the end. He gets shot in front of kids who are like worshiping him, basically, right? And it's like kind of sad because like they're sort of to blame, but he didn't have to jump in front of the gun to protect them. So kind of his fault.
But yeah, so the relationships between characters are very much the same from Magnificent Seven to Seven Samurai, except that I think was a little expanded in the Magnificent Seven.
They expanded upon? So they expanded into a 2-hour movie versus a 3.5-hour movie? How did they do that?
They kind of like, for that character, they wanted to have him have something special. In the, actually in Seven Samurai, the Toshiro Mifune character does not fall in love with the girl. Okay. One of the other seven do, but they combine those two roles for the Chico character.
Okay, gotcha.
So they like took some liberties. And there was nobody, and this was unique to the Magnificent Seven, which carried on to the remake, was the guy who was suffering from post-traumatic stress.
Yeah, that was,
interesting portrayal of PTSD.
Right, well, first of all, I don't know why they had to make him like a metrosexual. You know, like, of course, so you're telling me the guy who sucks is like possibly the queer one.
You don't think that's progressive? Metrosexuals existed in the West, guys.
And they sucked, apparently.
And they had PTSD because they were too worried about getting their hair done. I mean, like...
And he dies.
He does, yeah.
Insults swallowed. None. Enemies. None.
No enemies?
Alive.
I never thought he was a metrosexual in all my years watching it. I never thought
he was, like, literally, like... he was dressed to the T. Like, look at how everyone else was dressed. Everything on him fit properly and was like always shiny.
Yeah.
He always had like his hair. I don't remember what his hair was like, but he always had a hat, right? But I feel like he was always very well dressed and well maintained.
Sure. Which
looked,
is, yeah.
He looked shiny compared to the dirty guys. So as I was watching this, I'm just equating him like, oh, so he's a homosexual.
Yeah.
And not to say anything about the latent homosexuality between Steve McQueen and
Yul Brynner.
Yul Brynner. Yeah. Those two. I mean, their scenes together, they're just like in love practically.
Yeah.
You know, just holding each other ever so slightly, looking each other's eyes.
Ben?
Howdy.
Like to buy you a drink?
Whiskey.
Got anything lined up?
Yeah.
And that's also an aspect of the Westerns that I thought you might like, is the homoeroticism.
Maybe I just don't like the idea of just being dirty.
Yeah.
All right. Like, gay sex has a lot of maintenance aspects, and those cowboys just don't have that maintenance. Right?
Granted, yes.
Which is so funny, right? Because speaking of the latent homosexuality, right? Like, it's just so funny because they kind of like, maybe the producers realize, they're like, you guys are looking too lovingly into each other's eyes. We're going to like make sure he's straight, like, by talking. It's just like, hey, do you have a sister for me?
Yeah.
Or when he's just looking longingly over, like, the women who are just washing clothes and stuff. It's just, yeah, like, ham-fisted in. I'm just like, guys, he's straight. He's not gay.
One of the things I loved about Seven Samurai is that when they decide, we need to go out and we need to hire people to save our town, mm-hmm, they spend a lot of time going and finding every single person. And they maintain that in The Magnificent Seven. They even maintain that in the remake, which we'll get to in a little bit. I love that we spend time getting to know who these people are by giving everybody their fair introduction, except for the Brad Dexter character, who I feel is just like, oh, hey, you want to be part of this? Okay, cool.
Which one's that character?
His name was Harry. Harry Luck. He's the most forgettable one, because if you think about it, it's Yul Brynner, obviously, the leader. Steve McQueen, his like homoerotic lover. Chico. Chico. Butchels, who's really emotionally volatile. He kind of pisses me off sometimes.
I can see that. He's easy to be pissed off at.
Yeah, like when Toshiro Mifune did it was charming, but when Horace Butchels, it doesn't transfer well.
It's annoying. He was annoying.
Come on now. And let's see how fast you are. And no games, huh? No flopping hands, none of that stuff. Just raw. Come on. Come on, raw!
Charles Bronson, we know who he was.
Right.
Robert Vaughn was a metrosexual. And then the other two, James Coburn, was the knife guy.
Okay.
And so I loved his intro.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, I thought he was so cool when I first saw that. And I still think he's like such a great intro.
Mm-hmm.
You tell him. I won, didn't I?
You lost.
Oh, yeah. So Harry's the guy who was like, who keeps believing there's something more. There's another reason why they're there.
Yeah.
He's the one who's there for the money.
Yeah.
Like, just harassing these poor Mexicans of just like, yo, where's the gold?
Yeah.
What gold, sir? It's just like, where's the silver? That's what I meant. Where's the silver? Where's the fucking gems?
Yeah. Like, why are we really hired to protect, like, your land?
All right. All that's on top. What's underneath?
Only what I told you.
Gold. Cattle. Payroll.
Only what I told you.
Oh, sure, never mind. Just tell me what you can.
Harry.
And then, so, my favorite thing about his character was just how he just ups and runs, mm-hmm, at the end. But he comes back, shoots like twice, and then gets shot and dies. Yeah. I'm just like, deservedly so, sir.
You're useless, pretty much. Yeah.
You know what it is? So I think this is one of my biggest complaints about the movie. They were all, so all the characters, sure, they had cool introductions. They had, some of them had like cool, I guess, powers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Skills. And they were all kind of flat. They were all kind of just one note, boring, like heroic characters. And true. I didn't jive with that, because they were just like, they were all just so like moral and upstanding. And it's just like, a good man defends the needy or something.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yul Brynner is my name.
The conflict, because, you know, this is based on a samurai film. So samurais have a very distinct personality and, mm-hmm, stuff. And so the Toshiro Mifune character in the original Seven Samurai, he's actually not a samurai. He's the son of a farmer, as we soon, you know, we find out. Just like in this one, we find out that Chico is the son of a farmer.
Right.
And he's pretending to be a gunslinger. And they kind of see through him, but they let him come. And they're like, oh my God, it makes sense. This is all too personal for you. So he's supposed to provide that heart and that clash.
Mm.
And all of the stuff that the samurai in Seven Samurai are, they, it's just not in them to express that.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't transfer over to the West as well. And I kind of agree with you that there is a flatness to it. And they're all just kind of like similar guys. Because a lot of these guys in other Westerns, like, they're fucking greedy assholes.
Right.
I wish we had more of Harry's and they would have been, like, the Brad Dexter character that we forget about, because that would have been, to me, a more accurate portrayal of how I would assume a cowboy is.
Yeah, 100%. I do agree with you there. I think the guy who was just after all that gold at the end, like, he wasn't there for the moral reason of protecting the town that can't protect itself, right? Yeah. He was after, like, this idea of, like, there's just some hidden treasures there. That was believable. So as forgettable as the character might have been compared to everyone else's moral upstandings, he was probably more relatable only because I feel like that'd probably be me.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to risk my life for these fucking poor people. However, if there's something for me in return, all right, then yeah, I'm in.
Yeah. In a weird way, he's the most forgettable character, but he's the most relatable.
Yeah.
Right. You guys would do the same. Don't even front, yeah. Guys. All right?
Don't judge. How would you react?
But no, yeah, I mean, that's why I didn't like Chris. Like, Chris was just like, ugh, everything to him was a morality thing. Or, like, even when he was talking to, like, the villagers, right? Like, it's just like, what do you guys want to do? We work for you. He's like, ugh.
Yeah, that's not, you're not being a real leader there. But know? Again, just Yul Brynner, he just pulls it off for me. I don't know. I will say one last thing about Westerns in general before we transfer over to the remake. Is that, I guess, also the reason why I kind of like or will forgive Westerns is that I'm not looking to get, like, my feminist fix from them.
Okay.
The lack of female representation and then the totally unfair representation. Like, they're women and they either portray mothers or whores, essentially.
Yeah, not a lot of whores in this movie.
No, not a lot.
Not a lot.
Just a lot of mothers and daughters.
Disappointing.
Yeah. I wanted to see some more of that.
Ready for every movie, not enough whores.
I mean, that's kind of like, if you want, I will say that, like, as a feminist, I know what I'm getting out of this. So, like, I can't give a shit because I already know what I signed up for. And like I said, I also just kind of enjoy the over masculinity projections.
Yeah, I guess maybe interestingly enough, maybe that's why I don't care for Westerns, because of that hyper masculinity.
Yeah.
That kind of, like, is just like, oh, this is what a real man is.
Yeah.
And me as a gay man, I feel like I am strong in my own ways.
Ooh.
Being a gunslinger isn't one of them. Showering is my way. And I feel like they don't do that.
Well, they didn't have showers. They had bathtubs.
Had rivers.
They had rivers. Yeah.
Right? Like, what's it called? Like, those women were washing clothes all the time, right? Well, they couldn't just use some of that water?
They could go to their local saloon and...
No, but the other... Yeah, so it's interesting, right? When you talk about, like, your feminist views, I understand... So yeah, so there's that hyper masculinity, that, like, kind of the strong, silent male figure, and I'm just like, that's not me. So it's just like, maybe that's just why I don't gravitate towards.
Well, it's also a very old time man. I can't tell you how many middle aged and up men I've spoken to who love Westerns and resonate with Westerns in terms of what it is to be a man.
Right.
You know, like, maybe not this movie, but a movie like High Noon or something. You know, like a sheriff protecting his town from three men out to, like, kill him. Like, that resonates with people,
right?
And, like, your pride and your dignity and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I find it intriguing, and it's something I aspire to understand more.
Okay.
And my dad also liked Westerns, so
gotcha.
Yeah,
my godfather did. My dad didn't. My dad never cared. He was also not one of those, like, you know, butch men.
Yeah, I think we kind of like. I think it boils down to our dads.
I think so.
Okay, so let's just let's move on ahead to 2016 and talk about the Antoine Fuqua remake. I can't really sing anything for that because there was, like, no music.
No, they still use a dum bum 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 at the end.
At the end, yeah. But when they introduced it, was like it had that weird, like, horn, like.
Yeah, the music was all over the place. I did not care for this movie's music. I don't know any of the stats or figures behind it, but I know that it starred Denzel Washington, Chris Pratt, Ethan Hawke, Vincent D'Onofrio, and forgettable people.
Oh my God.
Non-famous people.
Bun Hung Lee is actually pretty famous for martial arts films.
Who?
Exactly.
Bun Hung Lee.
He was the knife guy.
Oh, he was good.
Yeah. And then I don't really know the other actors.
Haley Bennett, it was the only female, so I guess I'll say her name.
Yeah.
I thought who looked
that guy pretty famous? Matt Bomer.
Matt Bomer was there for like a second. Right?
Yeah. In the beginning.
Matt Bomer was the first one to die, and shame on Antoine Fuqua to, like, what's it called? Kill the beautiful Matt Bomer. It was just Like, I would have kept him alive as long as possible and use his picture in all the promotions.
I was actually kind of shocked when I saw the film and it began like that and he died. I was like, oh, I thought he was a name.
Yeah, Matt Bomer's kind of a name. Yeah. You know?
That was, I liked that though. I'm like, yes, kill them.
Yeah, fine.
I will say the villain that they created with Peter Sarsgaard as Bartholomew Bogue was terrible.
I disagree.
You thought, well, I mean, as a person, I thought his acting was fantastic.
Oh, no. Okay. So, all right, fine. So I actually prefer this villain, Bogue, over Calvera.
Yeah, me too.
I prefer, like, way better villain because his motivations piss me off more.
Yeah.
He's very capitalistic, right? So this movie ultimately, the remake ends up feeling like a big fuck you to capitalism.
Yeah.
Because you have this character, Bogue, who... The reason he's coming to this town and, like, pillaging it, basically, is because he is a fucking rich asshole. And he feels like he has the right to.
Yeah.
You know? And these poor people have had enough. You know? Mm-hmm. It's definitely a 99 versus the 1% story.
Yeah.
For sure.
At one point, he says something along the lines of, you know, well, when Rockefeller...
Yeah, he compares himself to Rockefeller and, like... Rockefeller.
Carnegie.
Right. Carnegie.
Yeah. And he's like, you know, when their names are going to be in the history book, they're not going to talk about how they did this to towns. They're going to talk about their legacies.
Right.
And like, when I heard that line, that actually kind of like hit me too. I'm like, oh my God, this is actually probably the reality of what happened. And this is how you climb your way to the fucking top. Mm-hmm. And he's 100% right.
Yeah.
And not in a movie, that character would have gotten away with it.
Right. No, I agree. I think the only thing, the biggest flaw with the character was kind of like how just evil he was.
Yeah.
They could have added a little more dimension to him.
Yes.
But I think for the bad guy that he was, I think his motivations as a bad guy were way better than just the marauder Calvera. Who was just, you know, stealing because, like, corn prices went up.
Just
apparently.
An asshole Mexican. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know, like, he told Chico when Chico was in disguise. It's just like, yeah, we steal because corn prices have gone up and I don't want my men to go hungry.
Yeah, but I also...
Okay, cool, I guess.
I kind of like that he's just a fucking, like, vicious asshole because that's also... People like that existed.
I'm sure people like that existed, but I think... What really boiled my blood was just like, sure, he's just a bad guy. This guy was everything I hate about capitalism, right?
Yeah, it was
like
way
he
more
really
relatable.
He represents something that I despise.
Yeah.
And yeah, I related to that way more.
$20 for each parcel of dust, that is my offer.
My land is worth three times.
That's not less worth more than that.
You're stealing our land.
It won't sweeten.
It'll only sour.
I mean, I liked Calavera, but I do like this bad guy. He was just such a prick. He was so terrible.
He was.
He really boils your blood. Yeah. They said it. The beginning was beautifully done.
I agree.
And like, yeah, it just sets up the film. So I guess before we really, really get into it, let's just ask the plain old question. Did you like it?
Oh, actually, I think I enjoyed the remake more so than I liked the 1960 version.
I enjoyed the remake. I really did.
That's surprising, guys.
Yeah.
We need to have like a sound effect anytime Nicole enjoys a remake.
We should have like a board idea. For like liked, dislikes, yeah, yeah. See how many times an angel got their wings today. But I really did enjoy it. I think what I enjoyed about it too was that it really became its own film with still doing the basics of the Magnificent Seven story.
Right.
And this was very much a remake of the 1960 film. It did not take a lot from Seven Samurai, which is why we're doing this episode on the two Magnificent Sevens, mm-hmm. because one was more of a remake of, even though Magnificent Seven is a remake of Seven Samurai, this film was really
a rehashing
of that. Yeah.
Right.
So there are some similarities, you know, obviously the seven of them, they all get their cute little intros. Although there's a character I think that is totally favored throughout the movie. But whatever.
All right. We'll say it. Chris Pratt.
Yeah. Chris Josh Pratt's Faraday character is totally favored.
Right.
His like character intro is 20 minutes and then everybody else is just kind of like, oh, hey, join us.
In Hollywood's defense, like Chris Pratt was a big rising star in 2016. He's still like, he's A-list right now. Right. I think then he was still just off the heels of Guardians of the Galaxy.
Gentlemen, allow me a moment to show you something quite miraculous.
You just show us our money, Faraday.
52 cards. Pick a card.
I ain't playing no game.
You've got the drop on me. You'll get a hoot out of this.
All right. Again, spoiler for this movie, guys. But mm-hmm. I think Hollywood also did the brave. At least, all right. Maybe not Hollywood, but Fuqua did, or the writers did the smart thing of like, no, I'm going to say the producers. I'm giving credit to the producers because they could have like rewrote that.
Yeah.
They killed him off.
They did. Yeah.
They gave him one of the ones. They made him, you know, he was the big name.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, if you look at the 1960s, like, I'm sure Steve McQueen is a big name himself, right? Back then. They wouldn't kill him.
He was a growing
off.
Name, yeah.
Oh, he was a growing name. Denzel, probably similar
Denzel
to...
Denzel's a pretty big name, though, too. Denzel Washington.
Denzel Washington is a huge name.
Yeah, he is Hollywood gold royalty, you know?
Yeah. All right, so we have to talk about the fact that Antoine Fuqua, who did Training Day, I really, really appreciated that this was a black man perspective film.
Yeah.
And
with a black lead.
With the black lead.
Yeah.
The only thing I will say is that the intro of the character, Chisholm, that Denzel Washington played, was a little too similar to the Christoph Waltz scene in Django Unchained only a couple years earlier, where like he goes into a town, all of a sudden he just like kills someone, and then he's like, go get your sheriff, and he's like, puts up his hands, and he's like, by the way, this man is wanted, now pay me. It's like almost like it was a little too similar for me.
I'm also a licensed peace officer in the Indian Territories, all Kansas, Nebraska, and seven other states.
So this is one of my complaints about Westerns. It's in terms of film language, there's just like, it's tropey. And I think film language uses a lot of things that like us as a viewer just become accustomed to. So one of the things that scene, for example, had was just a lot of, for example, that shot of the boots coming through the, through the door and then rising up. And then you only see like the parting doors only ever so slightly, right? He goes through. It's just like, it's kind of stuff that filmmakers use, like kind of these signifiers to like, what's it called, for us as the audience to kind of get realized. It's like, all right, we're watching Western. Same thing, similar to like the kind of instruments that are used for the music. So this one used a lot of instruments that you would kind of associate with Westerns. And it kind of, I think it hinders it to a point, because I think this movie was actually enjoyable. And I think it had the potential to be really good if they had kind of held back on kind of becoming, kind of filling into those Western tropes. You know, of kind of hammering it over your head that this is a Western movie, guys.
But
in 2016.
I think that, are you a fan of genre film in general?
It depends on the genre.
Maybe then you're biased against that particular genre, because that's actually the thing that you don't like about it is what people do like about it and what people expect of it. They want those over-the-top Western things. They want the things that make a Western a Western. So, I get it. Like, and there are certain things that I'm like, yeah, okay, cutting to like, you know, the shoes and hearing the clicking of the boots and all that. But at the same time, that's also kind of like saying like, I really didn't like that it was a musical and they did all this singing. Like, there's things that you just kind of are part of the Western genre that people who like the genre very much look forward to, and what makes it that genre. So yeah, so totally favorited one character over the other, but I liked the inclusion of different faces that we don't really see in the West. I don't know if I believe that this would have been believable. There wasn't enough. Denzel Washington's character did not experience enough racism. Now, granted, I would have gotten tired if the whole film was everywhere he went, he experienced racist like people, but that would have been slightly more realistic.
Yes.
He just is kind of like there, and everybody, for the lack of a better word, kind of accepts
him. It was like Blazing Saddles. Like, you know, it was just like, all right.
Nobody accepts him in Blazing
Saddles.
That's
true. No, you're right.
They make a whole joke out of it.
Yeah, he wasn't even just a black man. He was also like a black lawman.
Yeah, he could have been someone from the North that came down and chose that life for some reason. But Billy Rocks, the Asian man.
Yeah.
Through knives.
The Oriental, as they kept referring to him as.
Yes, which is era appropriate dialogue.
That was probably what they would have called him.
Yeah. And then
call him that now.
Yeah.
We can't call him that.
No, he's not a rug, guys. We will not call him that. And then Martin Sansmeyer, who played Red Harvest,
My god, now that I thought Chris Pratt would have been the one who made my girdle gooey. It was not. It was actually the Red Harvest guy.
He had paint on his head. You
Red Harvest
that?
Was so hot. He was just so hot.
That's interesting that, oh my God. Yeah. I'm so shocked that you didn't like Yul Brynner now.
Why?
Because what is it about Red Harvest that like he fits the bill for the reasons why you didn't like the other guys? Is it just physically you found the man very attractive?
He was just like physically just a gorgeous specimen of a man.
All right. You know?
Outpath, we go to fight wicked men.
What did he say?
Said he's with us.
There was one other character though, Vasquez. Sorry.
The Mexican.
Yeah. Who kind of played the Harry role in this one.
Yeah.
And I was a little upset that the only Latino character didn't really get much more screen time and cred, but at least he lived.
Yeah, he did he? Oh, yeah. He did live. Yeah, he did.
Red Harvest and Denzel lived.
Mm-hmm. Poor Lakeness. $500 reward.
Well, you intend to get that reward.
this version, they kept the soldier with PTSD.
Yes.
I liked the Goodnight Robichaux's version of post-traumatic stress.
That was Ethan Hawke.
Yeah.
Right.
I thought that was really well done.
I think, I think the friendship that he had with Billy was really nice.
Yeah.
Because it's funny, right? Because it's hard to do like romantic things without feeling like, again, latent homosexuality. I think they did theirs properly, where it was just like, it was like respectful, not like silly.
You gotta hate what you're firing at. Hate it. Come on, get some gravel in your craw.
Again, don't know how believable it is, but like we said earlier, there's an aspect of fantasy to the West, and I would love to think that this West was so inclusive. And that they're okay with the woman too, like,
yeah, they're okay with a woman just holding a gun.
Of course, like, too, but like there's, you know, he's a black man is leading it, there's a Native American, and then there's an Asian, but everyone has a problem with the woman. That's very much still a problem in the West. Like, that was like,
you're supposed to be teaching. Denzel was very much like, it's just like, you're just a lady, you gotta like, what's it called,
yeah,
you go tend to the children. Mm-hmm. And she's like, I plan on fighting, and he's just like, well, if you fight, like, then we're all dead. Like,
yeah.
I think that's literally one of the lines.
I have a proposition. Some man named Bo wants to mine our valley and take it from us. We're decent people being slaughtered in cold blood.
One thing you said about the Yul Brynner character that you didn't like, Chris, was that he was so heroic, and he was like, whatever you'll do, we'll do. And that Denzel was much more of a leader. But at the same time, the motive for why he did this came to light at the end. And I really enjoyed that.
Oh, I love that too. Well, that's because, Chris Chisholm's character had that potential of falling into like kind of that upstanding moral character.
Mm-hmm.
But when that, and I also respect the filmmakers here for kind of withholding that information. Like, we knew there was something up, like why he took this mission. He held it close to his chest. And I love that they did that until the very moment you needed that information.
Yeah.
Because a lesser filmmaker would have had a flashback scene. Like him sleeping and then like having the flashback of like what happened.
True. That's true.
You know, they held it and they played it like matter of factly at the end. But yeah, it was at the end of the day, it was a revenge story.
Mm-hmm.
And that starts changing kind of the morality of this character, right? Because revenge is inherently immoral, mm-hmm. right? Man is not, you know, supposed to play judge and executioner. He did. Yeah. But that's because, as far as he was concerned, like, you know, they raped his mom, they killed his sister, you know, they lynched him.
Yeah.
So it's just like, he, you know, as a passive film goer here, I felt like he was well within his right.
No, and, definitely. It made him almost more humane. And you're like, oh, now it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it all kind of like adds up at the end.
So, yeah. So I was very much, I think I applauded that moment when it was just like when he's, because it was also such a slow burn too, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, you have Bo just kind of begging for his life and stuff, and being the JJ, he's clearly supposed to be like, money can't buy him out of the situation, right?
Yeah.
So he's just there crying for his life. And like, then Denzel reveals it, just like, this is why I'm doing this. It's not for, what's it called? It's not for the moral reason. I'm not doing mm-hmm. this to take this down. It's because mm-hmm. of you.
Yeah, because I want to fucking see you suffer now. Yeah, I loved that. When that mm-hmm. happened at the end, I was like, yes, just take, you know, like, lose yourself in that moment. And then they made Bogue, like, sniveling, and he was like, oh, well, you know, please, like, forgive me. And you made him
sniveling at the end, and at the same time, he was so, well, I think, the other thing I liked about that scene, like, mm-hmm. this is the very ending we're talking about, but, you know, Bogue was about to get the upper hand on Chisholm.
Yeah.
And he gets rescued by the lady.
By the lady. Yeah,
it's just by the lady. He's just like, you put that gun down and you tend to the children.
Yeah. Fuck yeah. And then I also love her representation of like, you know, there is something to be a man. A man can hold a gun and a man can hold his own, and he can like face danger and not back away from it. And she challenged all of that. Mm-hmm. So I liked her representation of channeling what Westerns view as typical masculine behavior. Mm-hmm. And so I liked that. I appreciated that. There are things about this film, just like with the 1960 film, that like when you watched the 1960 film, that you were like, oh, that was so typical of like films of that era. Like, oh, it just plays like an average 1960s Hollywood film. Well, this film also plays like a typical 2016 film. And there are just some moments in editing and like music cues and stuff that I was just kind of like rolling
especially
my eyes at.
Especially music cues. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
But and the action sequences were kind of a little on the lackluster side.
Yeah.
It was too edity, right?
Yeah, it was because, too fast, too much. Yeah.
When one of the few things when I studied Kurosawa was in terms of like how he filmed his fight scenes, right?
Beautiful.
It's about, right. And it's about also the lack of action sometimes in his mm-hmm. scenes. And, you know, 2016 exactly. movies no longer, that's not a rule they follow. It's
no, yeah.
all about seeing every shot, every.
Everything that Kurosawa established in 1954 has gone to shit, guys.
So, yeah. But... So, but I think I did enjoy these action sequences more so than I like the 1960s version.
True. I wish there was a nice balance in between the two.
I agree. I think the 2016 version could have held back a little.
Yeah.
That's a problem now with, like, I guess our movies. Everything's about the spectacle of, like, these big grand fight scenes at the end.
Yeah. And it was a little too not like your West, though, because the nice thing, too, about these films is that you just kind of, like, shoot a couple bullets mm-hmm. and then everybody falls to the ground.
Right. This one had bombs. This one had arrows.
And then they brought out the
snipers.
Yeah. The whole shebang, yeah.
The which Gatling
is a little
gun.
Unrealistic that they
which only
had 7 days.
I love the Gatling gun, though. Like,
yeah, the Gatling gun was so
the
intense.
The Gatling gun was great because also I think that just upped the stakes a little more so yeah. than I think the 1960 version had, right?
Yeah.
Now there was like an actual obstacle between victory.
Yeah.
Where they didn't have really that. Like, they just were outnumbered in the 1960
and
version.
And it's more accurate of what a massacre would have looked mm-hmm. like, so.
Do you want to do a lightning round?
Let's do lightning round. Yeah, okay, so between Denzel Washington's Chisholm and Yul Brynner's Chris.
Chisholm, for me.
I do really like Chisholm. I loved everything about him, but I vocalized my love for Yul Brynner. So my heart's with Yul Brynner. I think the Faraday Chris Pratt equal would have to be Steve McQueen.
I would agree, yeah, 100%.
Tanner. Yeah.
McQueen. Not McQueen, I'm sorry. Faraday.
I'm going to go with Vin Tanner, okay. Steve McQueen. This is where it gets a little hazy, but I'm going to say Robert Vaughn as Lee with the post-traumatic stress and Ethan Hawke as Goodnight Rabbit.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, Ethan Hawke's character.
Ethan Hawke's yeah. for sure. Yeah. James Coburn as Britt, the knife guy. And then Bong Hung Lee as Billy Rocks.
Equal, I think, for me. Yeah. I think I like them both.
Me too. Yeah. But I might slightly like Billy a little bit more.
Which one's Billy?
The remake.
The remake?
Yeah.
The remake one was cool. He was just cool. Like, yeah. He was just cool, calm, collected. He had a mm-hmm. cool look, everything about him. You know, just for an sure. Asian hanging out to Western. Like, how often do you see that?
Yeah, never. You never see that unless it's, yeah. Charles Bronson as Bernardo or Vincent D'Onofrio as
Ooh,
Jack.
I actually liked both. And I think I was so heartbroken when Vincent D'Onofrio's character died.
Yeah, right?
I was so sad. Because I liked it, right? He was kind of like this big bear of a man who was kind of spiritual, though, in mm-hmm. a weird way. But Pierce Brosnan's scene also was another one that got me like, oh, fuck.
I love it so much.
Charles Bronson's scene really got me emotionally, I think. So I'm going to.
That would be great if Pierce Brosnan was in the 1961.
So I'm going to go with Charles Bronson's character.
I'm going to go with Charles Bronson, too. Brad Dexter's Harry Luck versus Manuel Garcia, his Vasquez.
I think I'll go with probably Vasquez. He was hotter. I'm going physical on that one.
Yeah, I'll agree with you, yeah. And this is shitty because there's not really a Chico equal.
It's true. There's not really a Chico equal. Who would be...
Well, we'll have to, by default, give it to Red Harvest.
Oh, Red Harvest for me.
Okay, yeah, I think
I mean, they were both two
Harvest.
Gorgeous guys. Yeah, I could see them both getting it on. But
you thought Horace Butchos was gorgeous.
I think he was very hot. He was like kind
he looked
of,
like a 12-year-old.
No, he looked like a scrawny little 19-year-old twink that you might see on Sean Cody. That's a reference to the gays, guys.
Villains, Calvera versus Bogue.
Oh, Bogue.
Yeah, Bogue. I'm going to have to go Bogue too. Yeah. And then the interchangeable Three Farmers or Haley Bennett.
Ooh, actually, I might go with the Farmers.
Yeah.
I kind of like the idea of, like, you know, I mean, interesting they chose to have a white town being the ones protected by a black man.
Yeah.
You know, usually flipping that trope of the white savior. But,
true.
You know, I got to represent my Hispanic peeps here.
That's true. Aw. You know what? I'm going to shed some light as to why the 2016, because we established why the 1961 was made. Right? We established that?
Yeah.
Because Westerns, like movies Hollywood were dying, yeah. people okay. like people, yes. still, and they were like, let's give him some more of the old
Nicole's history lesson, of course.
I think that the 2016 remake happened because of the immediate success of the Tarantino Westerns of Django Unchained and The Hateful Eight, and also because of Tarantino's take of putting a black man, giving him fair representation into the American West that, you know, people wanted to see. I think people want to see more of that. I hope people want to see more of that. That's just Hollywood assuming that. But they also did the wise choice because there was a lot of controversy. You know, why is a white man making these representations of black men in the West?
Right.
So it they were like, let's give this film, let's take a classic film, one that we all have, like, we either know about it or we love it or we have our feelings about it, whether it is we like it or not, and let's give it a new twist by a new perspective.
Interesting.
And I think I'm going to say we needed this remake. I don't know if the result of it is what we needed, but the fact that we approached it this way, we're reevaluating the West and we're giving it new perspectives to freshen it up because we don't know that much about this part of our culture and our history. So we can very much make it as realistic and as raw as we know it to be.
Or as fantastical.
So we can kind of combine it to be the both, right?
Right.
And so I think they really hit the nail on the head with this one because it was like, it was dirty, it was grungy, massacres were happening, terrible things were happening. But at the same time, these seven men were able to save a town, you know? Yeah. So it's like reality and fantasy and all these things and putting equal representation into cinema that we need.
Yeah. I agree with you. I think representation is needed and important, especially upon learning that there's like this unwritten history about African-American cowboys.
Yes.
And I don't remember if you saw, we've been to an exhibit where they had, what's it called? They had black cowboys. Outside of Blazing Saddles, I had never seen a black cowboy, right? Mm-hmm. And to go to this exhibit, right, in which it was an actual, it was like a installation of actual black cowboys, right? It almost like documentary-like.
Yeah.
And it was fascinating. So yeah, seeing this on the screen, even in a narrative fictional form, I think is important.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, I think this remake was needed.
I definitely, yeah. It might not be, like I said earlier too, it might not be realistic, but at the same time, we have that liberty with Westerns because we don't really know what the West was like to take these liberties ourselves. And I'm just like, I'm really happy actually. Yeah. And then it's also reintroducing the Western into the mainstream life. And I'm all for that. Let's redefine Westerns and make them cool again, guys.
Yep. Yep. All right. I guess it's, should we move on to some news?
Let's get some news.
Eddie.
So moving from cowboys, let's talk about aliens. 1999, at the time, WB had released a new show about three aliens living in Roswell, New Mexico.
Oh my God, are we talking about Roswell?
Well, Comic-Con dropped...
you got my excitement.
Comic-Con dropped a reboot of Roswell.
Oh, they're doing a...
Yes.
A reboot. Okay.
So it's called Roswell, New Mexico. This cast are adults, so it's going to be dealing with more adult themes.
Uh-huh.
So one of the prominent themes is immigration. Too.
Oh, so we're going to talk about
immigration. It's also a diverse cast.
Are the aliens Latinos?
The aliens are not Latinos, but other characters. Other characters are. Okay. Other characters will be Latinos, Mexican. They either will be Mexican or Mexican descent.
That would be a little too on the nose, I think.
Yeah.
Thank you, Eddie Z. What do you think about this?
So I don't know if it's obvious at this point that I didn't really watch CW growing up.
Oh my God, I lived on the CW.
The WB, whatever it was called.
Giving me now Dawson's Creek.
When I was 11, I was watching old movies. That's when I started becoming obsessed. But I do know of Roswell, and I know my history in terms of Roswell 1947, and I love the Futurama episode where they go to Roswell.
That's a good one, right? With the time paradox, basically. Yeah.
And the Twilight Zone, too.
Yeah, I'm going to give a confession. I was trying to write, me and my friend were trying to write, like, get into that teen novel craze. And we were going to do a story about, like, we were going to try to do a book on, like, angels and demons. But my pitch was essentially just a ripoff of the very first episode of Roswell. With aliens instead of angels. There's even going to be the scene in my book where, like, the guy lifts his shirt and it's, like, a glowing handprint on him.
Okay.
I was swapping roles here.
Okay.
But that's, I think, the most iconic image I have of Roswell. Like, Shelby Appleby.
Did you ever write it?
We wrote like a couple of chapters and sent it out to some publishing houses and they laughed at us.
That's adorable. No, I mean, I will totally check this out. And if we do this for the show, then I'll totally not bitch and moan about it.
It's what's it called? It's like the first season was pretty good.
Okay.
I enjoyed it. So yeah. All right Eddie cool. Z, that was good news. It got me super excited. So.
How about we end the show with me singing the theme to Rawhide? I might not know a bunch of shit, but I know every single word to the TV show theme song for Rawhide. Do you know what Rawhide is?
I don't even know what Rawhide is.
I'm showing my age and I'm 29. This is really bad.
Yeah, I'm older than you.
Okay, then never mind.
No, do it. That'll be a good way to end it. Guys, I'm leaving you off with Nicole.
So until next time, stay unoriginal. Keep moving, moving, moving. Oh, they're disapproving.
I know this
Keep
song.
Keep them doggies moving. This Rawhide.